I'd like to dedicate this lecture to my wife, who gave up her career so we could allow me to continue in my career while we raised four children. So the title is Sieve Methods and the Distribution of Primes, and always impressive to start out with some conjectures on prime numbers, since it seems like many of the very most famous conjectures in mathematics are conjectures about prime numbers, especially so now that Professor Wiles has removed one non-prime number conjecture from the list. So the first one is the Riemann hypothesis, which started out as a conjecture about prime numbers, although it's morphed into a conjecture about everything under the sun, it seems like. There's the Goldbach conjecture, that if you take an even integer, at least four, that it can be written as the sum of two primes. There's the twin prime problem, that there exist infinitely many pairs of primes differing by two. And my personal favorite is the conjecture that n squared plus 1 is infinitely often a prime number when n is an integer. And all of these conjectures generalize very considerably, the Riemann hypothesis in particular, but all of them. Okay, next let's mention, I wonder if I can do this without tearing this back and forth. Let's mention some old results about primes. Oh, thank you. Thanks, Jim. Okay, so that'll... Wait a second. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't I try that? I'll be in people's way if I do that, depending on who you are, where you are, I mean. Okay, let me try it here, and if too many tomatoes come my way, I'll switch. So some of the oldest results on primes, Euclid, who lived in Alexandria about 300 BC, which is something I only found out while I was preparing this lecture, thanks to a very old version of the edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, gave the proof that there are infinitely many prime numbers, and I can never state that theorem without giving the proof, because the proof is so short, and you just consider the integer you get by multiplying the first n primes and adding 1, and you get an integer which is not divisible by any of the first n primes, and by the fundamental theorem of arithmetic must be divisible by some prime, so there's an n plus first one. Eratosthenes, about 250 BC, gave an algorithm to find primes. This is known as the sieve of Eratosthenes, which we will come back to. And I'm sorry, I haven't studied the subject well enough to look into the early advances of Asian mathematicians, Chinese, Indian. So therefore, I jump to Euler, being a Westerner, I jump to Euler, who considered the Riemann zeta function, although he didn't call it that. If we let S be a real number larger than 1, then by the fundamental theorem of arithmetic, we can write this absolutely convergent series as an infinite product and rewrite it like this. And using the fact that the harmonic series diverges, if we let S approach 1 from the right, then we see that not only are there infinitely many primes, but a little thought discloses this must mean that the sum of the reciprocals of the primes diverges. So this is a stronger statement. Okay. Okay, so Eratosthenes' sieve works something like this. Let's consider, for example, the set of integers up to x, and let x be 30. And we come to the first integer bigger than 1, 2, which must be a prime number, and then we cross out all the multiples of 2. And then we look at the next integer, which has not been crossed out, that's 3, so we cross out all multiples of 3. And then we go to the next uncrossed integer, 5, and cross out all multiples of 5. When we do this, we notice that everything that's left over after we've done this is a prime number, and that's because we've crossed out the multiples of every prime up to root 30, up to the square root of x. If we want to count the number of primes that are left, then we have to take into account the fact that first, for these primes, 2, 3, and 5, we've subtracted from x the number of multiples of p, but then some integers like 6 get crossed out twice when we cross out multiples of 2 and when we cross out multiples of 3, so they have to be added back in. And that's so for each pair of primes p1 less than p2, we have to add back in the number of multiples of p1, p2. And then when we get up to something that's a multiple of 3 primes, which is why we go up to 30 in this example, we see there's something that's been a multiple of 3 primes, and let's see, we subtracted it 3 times, and then we subtracted it, added it back in 3 times, but it's not a prime, so we want to subtract it out again. And if we do this, what we are left with is, if pi of x denotes the number of primes up to x, then we're left with the number of primes up to x, but not, we've crossed out the number up to root x, and we never crossed out the integer 1. So this formula is a complicated way of counting the primes between root x and x. And although it's referred to as the sieve of Eratosthenes, even in this generality, it was only written down by Legendre, I believe, in 1808. So this is known as the Legendre formula. Nope, we don't want page 1. Okay, well, we've already sort of come across, in disguise, a couple of times, the Möbius function. In the first place, when we talked about Euler, we were looking at zeta of f, and we gave the infinite the Euler product, so 1 over zeta of s looks like this, and if we expand that in a Dirichlet series, we get coefficients, which we call the Möbius function, and it records minus 1 to the r if n is the product of r distinct primes, and it's 0 if n has a square factor. Using the terribly deep formula that zeta s times 1 over zeta s is 1, if we expand this, if we multiply together these two Dirichlet series and compare coefficients, we get the basic formula, the basic property of the Möbius function, where this indicates we sum over those integers d, those positive integers d, which divide evenly into n. So we get 1 if n is 1 and 0 otherwise. Using this little formula for the Möbius function, this definition actually, we see that we can rewrite the Legendre formula. The Möbius function allows us to rewrite the Legendre formula in a compact notation like so, where capital P, badly written, is the product of the primes up to square root x. So this is just rewriting Okay, Legendre, about the same time as he wrote his formula, was making a conjecture about the number of primes up to x. And Gauss announced quite a number of years later that he had made a conjecture quite a number of years earlier. And that conjecture is known as the prime number theorem, that pi of x is asymptotic to the integral from 2 to x, let's say, of dt over log t. And it's easy to see, this is the form that Gauss conjectured it. Legendre more or less conjectured that it was asymptotic to this. It's easy to see that these two are asymptotic to each other. Just if you integrate this by parts a few times, you get an asymptotic series for this integral, of which this is the leading term. And asymptotic, for us, means that as x goes to infinity, the ratio of f over g goes to 1. That's what f asymptotic to g means to us. Meanwhile, almost meanwhile, soon thereafter, Dirichlet, over a period of about 5 years, proved that there were, if we take relatively prime integers, then there are infinitely many primes in the arithmetic progression a modulo q. And moreover, that if you sum the reciprocals of those primes, you get a divergent series. And that should remind you a little about Euler's proof, and about Euler's theorem, and in fact this was a generalization of Euler's proof, but it was a really fantastic generalization. I can't say too often how much I admire Dirichlet's proof of this theorem. He generalized Euler's proof. He introduced characters, which already had been around a little bit to the extent of the Legendre symbol. And really, this was a tour de force that had a lot to do with the beginnings of analytic number theory, representation theory, harmonic analysis. I like that proof. Okay, so let's pass on to Chebyshev, who in the 1850s made the first serious attempts at the prime number theorem. Let's recall the zeta function is given by this product, and if we take the logarithm of that and then we differentiate it and then throw a minus sign on both sides, then we get the following Dirichlet series for minus zeta prime of s over zeta s. It's given by a Dirichlet series, which again is convergent, absolutely convergent for s bigger than 1. S is a real number still. And lambda n lives on the prime powers. It's log p if n is a power of the prime p, and it's zero otherwise. It turns out that this is a very convenient function to work with. It's called the von Mangold function today, although Chebyshev didn't know von Mangold was going to come along later, I think. So it's a very convenient way, it's a very convenient way to count the primes. If we count the Chebyshev, the lambda n's up for n up to x, we get something denoted psi of x called the Chebyshev function. And it turns out, and it's not too hard to show, a little integration by parts here and there, that the asymptotic formula psi of x asymptotic to x is equivalent to the prime number theorem. So in the sense that it's not too hard to to go from one to the other, it's much easier to go from one to the other than it is to get to either one. And there's a similar equivalent statement about the Möbius function, which I remembered late in the transparency, so I just snuck it in there. If you sum the Möbius function up to x, little o of x means that if you divide this by x and let x go to infinity, the limit's zero. So asymptotically, half the integers up to x, asymptotically, as many integers up to x have mu equal 1 as have mu equal minus 1. Well, so mu is sort of similar to lambda in that sense, and it's also similar in another sense. We got a very simple formula for the Möbius function, for the sum of the Möbius function over the divisors of a given integer, and starting from an equally trivial identity that minus zeta prime over zeta multiplied by zeta is minus zeta prime, if we compare the coefficients, we get a very simple formula for the sum of the von Mangold function over the divisors of n. So this is, if we take any integer n and sum the von Mangold function over the positive integers that divide it, we get log n. Well, Chebyshev used this formula. If you want, it's not too hard to compute the sum of log n for n up to x. You know how to integrate log up to x, and if you're Archimedes, you know that you can sum the areas of some rectangles and get something that's not too far from the integral. And so you can show that the sum of log n as n goes up to x is asymptotic to x over log x. On the other hand, using that formula, we can rewrite that sum as a double sum like this, and then we can x log x. Well, if you integrated log t for t up to x, you haven't taught calculus for a while, I think. Did I? I'm sorry. I apologize, sir. No, I did? Okay, guys. I wrote it right. Yeah, my classes know I do this all the time. Okay, so it's x log x, sorry. If I rewrite it like this and then interchange the order of summation, then this inner sum is just the integer part of x over d, the number of multiples of d up to x. And you can believe without too much work that if you replace the integer part of x over d by x over d, you just make a little error. It turns out that that's true. Sometimes that's sleight of hand is not so easy. And then lambda d, for the most part, comes from the primes, from the higher powers. There are far fewer p squareds up to x than there are primes, and so on. So this is almost, and not too hard to show, is asymptotic to this. And so from this formula and this formula, Chebyshev deduces this asymptotic formula. So it's very interesting, I think, that the asymptotic formula for this guy, which is almost the Chebyshev function, is very tough. But if you put the P down there, it's much easier. Well, using ideas along the same lines, but more complicated versions, Chebyshev was also able to show that indeed x over log x was the right order of magnitude for the prime counting function, in the sense that there exist positive constants c1 and c2, so that pi of x over x upon log x is bounded above and below by these positive constants. Okay, then we come to Riemann. Riemann had the really fundamental idea of looking at the zeta function as a function of a complex variable. And it's easy to see, if you know what a function of a complex variable is, it's not too hard to see that this is an analytic function in the half-plane real part of S bigger than 1. And Riemann gave a meromorphic continuation to the complex plane, that it was holomorphic apart from a simple pole at S equal 1, having residue 1. He showed there are infinitely many zeros, and he proved a so-called explicit formula for the Chebyshev function psi of x. He uses the same notation as Chebyshev 8 years later, 7-8 years later, without mentioning Chebyshev. But anyway, psi of x is given by an x, which comes from the pole at s equals 1, minus a sum over the zeros of the infinitely many zeros of the zeta function. Roughly how this is proved is to write rho as a product over its zeros, or zeta as a product over its zeros, and then take the log, then the derivative, and then use the residue theorem. If we examine this formula, this rough formula, we know we want to prove that psi of x is asymptotic to x. In other words, we want to show that sum over the zeros is small. So that's the problem to show. Now, if you look at a term, x to the rho over rho, the modulus of x to the rho is just x to the real part. And so what we'd really like to have is all these real parts as small as possible. Well, there's a functional equation, which Riemann also proved, which relates the Riemann zeta function at S to the Riemann zeta function at 1 minus S. In particular, this shows that zeta of S is 0 if and only if zeta of 1 minus S is 0. Well, that's almost true. There are certain zeros called the trivial zeros which don't quite satisfy this, but they're way over to the left. Their real part is very small. The Riemann hypothesis, which Riemann said seemed apparently to be true, at least in as I understand the German, says that the real part of rho is equal to a half for all the zeros except these trivial ones, and in that case it means the real part of rho is less than or equal a half. And this is best possible, of course, because of this relation, and so that's going to make those terms x to the rho over rho as small as we can hope to get them. And so it turns out you can show that the Riemann hypothesis is equivalent to a very good formula for psi of x, that it's equal to x plus an error term which is bounded by a constant times x to the half plus epsilon. For every epsilon greater than zero, there's a constant depending on epsilon such that psi x minus x is bounded by x to the constant x to the half plus epsilon. And let's keep the Möbius function tailing along with us. It says that the Möbius function, which looks very much like when it's non-zero on the square free integers, it looks very much like it's a random function of pluses and minuses, actually behaves that way. The sum of this is like root x, essentially. Well, then in 1896, I believe it was, Hadamard and de la Vallée-Poussin used Riemann's ideas and used a lot more of their own to prove the prime number theorem independently. Now, there have been in the intervening years many other applications of the analytic method in the study of questions involving primes. I'd say the most important are the asymptotic formula for the number of primes in an arithmetic progression. If phi of q, Euler's function, counts the number of residue classes modulo q, which are relatively prime to q, so these are the ones which can contain primes, then this formula says that each one of these residue classes, each one of these progressions, gets asymptotically its fair share of the primes up to x. Another important use of the analytic method, due to Hoheisel in the 30s, he showed that intervals like this, for some fixed theta less than 1, intervals like this contain primes as soon as x is large enough. In fact, that they contain as many asymptotically as they should. Now, this would follow for every theta bigger than a half, would follow trivially from the Riemann hypothesis. You just count the primes up to x to this point, count the primes up to this point, and subtract. But we don't know this with anything like this, an error term. So Hoheisel had to use some very innovative ideas to get around this. That would be a very nice theorem. Hoheisel's theorem was true for 1 minus a tiny, tiny number, and it's been chipped away at and for many, many years, and I think the current record is 0.525. So we're almost at a half. But I would love to see a proof with 0.499 in it that assumed the Riemann hypothesis even. Okay. Now, although the analytic method has been used for many other things, it doesn't really get very far with the type of conjectures like Goldbach that I mentioned at the beginning. And the reason is, well, one reason is the generating function, if we take a typical sequence of integers, a n, say this is the a n is the characteristic function of an interesting set of integers, and we look at this generating function, it just doesn't have the nice analytic properties that we need, that the Riemann zeta function has. Oh, no. Oh, well, okay. Thought this was an old transparency. It's not. Okay, so let's go back now to the sieve again. And look, let's start by generalizing Legendre's formula. So we'll take AN. AN is going to be a set of non-negative reals, a finite sequence, I'll call it, because I want to allow repetitions. And capital P is the product of the primes up to a point z. And what we're interested in doing is summing the ans just over those n which have no prime factor less than or equal z. So their GCD with this product is 1. That's just a brief way of denoting the fact that n has no prime factor less than or equal z. Okay, so we start out this thing then. Here all I've done in the first line is to use the basic property of the Möbius function to record this equation, this coprimality condition. And then on the next line, I use the fact from elementary number theory that the common divisors of 2 positive integers are exactly the divisors of the greatest common divisor. So I can write this sum over the greatest common divisor as a sum over the common divisors. And the point in doing that is once I've separated out these two conditions, I can interchange the sum. And here I've written it as a sum over the divisors of this product, mu d ad, where ad is the sum of the an's over those n which are divisible by d. So remember when we were talking about the sieve of Eratosthenes, we wanted to count how many integers up to x were even, how many were multiples of 3, how many were multiples of 6. That's what this is doing. Okay, now, we're going to assume, we start out by assuming that we have a fairly simple approximation formula for the mass AD. And AD represents the mass of the sequence coming from the multiples of D, and we assume that it's a simple function g of d times the total mass, a sub 1 is just using this notation, sometimes I'll call it a, and in our example, the total mass was x, the number of multiples of d was the integer part of x over d, and if we wanted to count this, if we wanted to estimate these things, we'd write it as a main term x of d, so that's the total mass times the multiplicative function 1 over d, together with a remainder term. So g of d is a nice function, and it's 1 over d in the example. It'll be a multiplicative function in the sense that, and that refers to the fact that we're thinking of the divisibility of these guys by one prime as being independent of the divisibility by another prime. And that's reflected in G being a multiplicative function. And of course, it's between 0 and 1 like a probability because we can't get more than the whole works divisible by D. And we get at least 0 of it divisible by d. Now r of d is going to be a remainder term, and we're going to need to assume that at least it's small on average over d. Now we're going to take that last formula there for s of a, which I've called s of a z here, God knows why. Well, it's the same different notation for the same sum, and I'm going to substitute in that this formula, and then I get this. Okay, now let me show you some examples of how this can be set up. Example number 0 is the one we've already looked at. We take A to be the set of integers up to X, and the result is if we can estimate this SAZ when A is root X, we can count the primes. In our next example, take A to be the characteristic function, actually, using the notation, on the set of integers n squared plus 1 up to x. In this case, it just turns out that our multiplicative function, well, it's multiplicative, so once it's defined on the primes, it's defined. We only need it on square-free integers. It's essentially like 1 over p. Well, not quite. It's 2 over p for this half of the primes, and it's 0 over p for this half of the primes. So similar to 1 over p. And if we could estimate the sifting function, if we could sieve up to square root x, z equals square root x, what we'd be left with would be primes of this form. So if we could estimate that, that would be good. Next example, look at the integers of the form n times n plus 2 up to x. In this case, it turns out, this is a little different, that g of p is 2 over p almost all the time. except for the special prime p. And if we could estimate this even up to square root, the fourth root, because that would take the product up to root, then we'd have integers n times n plus 2, where neither n nor n plus 2, both n and n plus 2 were primes. So we'd get twin primes. The next example gives another way of looking at the twin primes. Instead of starting with the integers n and n plus 2 and their product, we just start with a set of things of the form p minus 2, where p runs through primes. And again, if we could sieve this successfully up to root x, we'd get twin primes. And final example, since we need to get Goldbach in here, if n is a large even integer, and we let a be the set of things of the form n minus p, as p runs through the primes up to n, then g of p has a fairly simple form I've written here. And if we could go up to root n, we'd essentially count, not quite, we'd count most of the ways of writing n as a sum of two primes. So we'd be trying to attack the Goldbach problem. Okay, now let me go back. This is just this formula which was right here at the bottom a minute ago. And if D is not too large, it turns out in the above examples that we can almost show that this remainder is bounded by 1 on average. And better than that really is impossible. And hence we get a bound for the remainder term. Well, the bound for the remainder term, the mu's are bounded by 1, the r's are bounded by 1 in some sense, is just the number of terms in the sum. But that's the number of divisors of this p, which is the product of the primes up to root z, So it's 2 to the pi z, and this is astronomical. So this can be improved, but actually, in this format, using the Möbius function and the sieve of Eratosthenes, it turns out that the error term, even if you were able to successfully estimate it very precisely, it's just as large as the main term. And Brunn in 1915, or around 1915, got the idea which turned that brought the subject of sieve methods to life. He asked what happens if you replace this Möbius function mu d by some other function lambda d. And the key is that mu of d is, there are too many terms in here, and mu of d has a very, it goes on forever. Why don't we pick a function lambda d which truncates? And then we can say the number of terms in this sum is under control, because there is only a certain number of them. And we'll still insist that lambda d be less than or equal 1, so our remainder term then is going to be bounded like this, and if we can get r of d's bounded by 1 on average, this is bounded like d, which could be as small as we want. Well, how can this be any useful? I mean, what good is it to have the error term small if the main term tells us nothing? Because we're certainly going to lose the asymptotic. Recall, we had this basic property of the Möbius function, and that's what made the whole thing work. On the other hand, we can't keep the Möbius function. Well, it turns out that when you ask for a little easier restriction, you ask that instead of getting equal to 0 for all n greater than 1, you get greater equal 0 for all n greater than 1. If you only ask that, Then it turns out there's lots of sequences, lambda d, which satisfy that. And you can cut off d pretty well where you want. Now, you're not going to get an asymptotic formula for the thing you were looking for, but if you go through the argument, you see you get an upper bound. So you get an upper bound for what you want that looks very much like the thing at the top there, except it's less than or equal, and we've got new names for these mu d's. They're now called lambda d's. In the same fashion, there are lots of choices of the sequences lambda d, which truncate at d less than d, and I guess we need the first one to be 1, and such that we get the opposite inequality. And if we plug that into the little manipulation we did before, we get a lower bound, which looks the same, but with this as this, but with a greater equal sign and a different sequence lambda d's. Now, it turns out that although this is a great idea, it's still not good enough to get primes, because in order to get primes in most of our basic examples, we would need to take z as large as root x and still get a small remainder, r, in this remainder. And we're just not able to do that. Okay, well, what if we can do only less? Instead of sieving up to root x, suppose we can only sieve up to x to the 1 over 100. That's a lot less task. It turns out we get an upper bound of the right order of magnitude. And the reason for this, roughly, is, let me take the basic example of the integers up to x. The number of primes up to x is like x over root over log x. The number of integers up to x which have no prime factor less than x to the 1 over 100 is also like x over log x. Actually, it's a constant times x over log x. But so even though, because of that basic property, which also holds in more general sequences, although in most sequences we can't prove such things, because of that, even if we only sieve this far, we can still get an upper bound of the right order of magnitude. We get an upper bound for a much larger set, but it's only a constant times as big as the set we were looking for. So in this fashion, Brunn proved that, for example, with respect to the twin prime problem, if you count the number of primes up to x such that p minus 2 is prime, you get a constant times x over log squared x, a constant times the expected amount. And Erdős wrote 500 papers using the sieve method, and almost every time he used it, this is what he used, that if you only sieve up to something like this, you still get an upper bound of the right order of magnitude. That is by far the most useful thing that's been done with sieve methods. Okay, well, if you know that if you get a positive lower bound in your sieve, just going up to x to the 100, you don't know your set contains any primes. But you know it can't have more than 100 prime factors. It has integers with no more than 100 prime factors, because it has no prime factors less than the 100th root. So it can't have more than 100 of them. The integer would be bigger than x. So in this way, you prove that there exist infinitely many primes p such that p minus 2 has less than or equal 100 prime factors. Well, I'm sort of cheating here, because to prove this one, you also need something else that didn't come along until 40 years after Brunn. But hundred got chipped away down to 2 by about 1970. And a little later, Ivanyets, by Chen, a little later, Ivanyets proved the similar theorem for my favorite problem. He showed there are infinitely many integers n, such that n squared plus 1 is either prime or has two prime factors. We don't know which. Presumably they're both. Well, between 1915 and 1970, a great hunt went on for the best weights lambda d. And Brunn and Buchtab and Kuhn, Selberg, Yurkot, Rickert, Rosser, Ivanyets are some of the main contributors. And they got the sieve into a pretty good shape, but they still couldn't get prime numbers from it. They got integers with less than or equal two prime factors, but not prime numbers. And this turned out, this is because of something which is known in the trade as the parity problem. So let me give you some examples of sieve axioms. So remember, we had this approximation formula for the multiples of d, that it's roughly g of d times the total. G is a multiplicative function between 0 and 1. Here's a typical axiom which says g of d behaves a lot like 1 over d. If g of d, so if I sum g of p log p, I get something that's asymptotic to log x. That's a very standard assumption about the function g. Recall, in the case of g of d over d, is 1 over d, this is just log p over p. That's what Chebyshev proved 12 transparencies ago. We also need an axiom for the remainder term. I'm skipping over some details here. It's a rather complicated list of axioms, which are not always the same in different sources. But we have this error term, our remainder term, and we want it to be small compared to the main term. Well, the fact of life is that the larger we can take d, then the larger we can take z. There's a complicated relationship between how far you can show, the further you can show, the larger you can take d and show the remainder is small compared to the main term, the higher you can sieve up to. That's very believable, but the relationship between the two is a little complicated. It's also a fact of life that we can never take d to be larger than x, and if we're dealing with thin sequences, if we use this trivial bound d less than, lambda d less than or equal 1, we can't even take it larger than A, which is the total mass, which in the case of thin sequences is even worse. Okay. Well, Selberg, who I think among the leading people in sieve theory over the years, really was the one who was most interested in the theory of the sieve, not just the applications. He was interested in seeing just how far you could go with the sieve. And he came up with a bunch of counterexamples which showed there were certain things you couldn't do. And the very simplest one is to take A to be the set of integers up to X which have an even number of prime factors. Now, one can show, although it's not obvious, that this sequence satisfies all the basic sieve axioms. And it does so with d as essentially as large as you could possibly take it. On the other hand, there's an obvious fact that 1 is not an even number, so this sequence contains no primes at all. You agree? So the conclusion of this is that any theorem which applies to all the sequences that satisfy the axioms can't possibly produce primes. Just can't. In 1996, well, appearing in 1998, Henrik Ivanyets and I introduced a new axiom involving certain double sums that look like this. So it's a sum over M, sum over N in certain ranges, which I don't want to write down because it's complicated. And we take our sequence members AMN and weight them by the Möbius function of N. And we add the assumption to the basic assumptions that these sums are small. Now, it's not hard to see that this axiom fails for this sequence. Because for any fixed M, this sum over N will always, when mu is zero, is non-zero, will either have this inner sum, mu will always have the same sign. If M has an odd number of prime factors, then AMN here has to have an even number, so N has to have an even number. So the mu doesn't bounce between plus and minus 1. So this fails. So this is no longer a counterexample. Well, you can't prove a general theorem by showing that some old counterexample is no longer a counterexample. You still need the following two things. You first need to show that this extra axiom is enough to give you the primes. And the second thing you have to show is that you haven't just done some empty theoretical work, which in the sieve can happen. You can prove wonderful, beautiful theorems that will never apply to any sequence that anybody will ever be interested in. So you need to show there are interesting sequences which satisfy these axioms. But one, it does, and two, they're due. So we proved in 96 to 98 that for an appropriate positive constant C, we could count the primes, which were a square plus a fourth power. Now, this is a thin sequence. It's asymptotically constant, that constant times x to the 3/4 over log x. So in some sense, now, this is really taking a liberty. In some sense, it's halfway between proving their primes of the form a squared plus b squared and proving their primes of the form a squared plus 1. I expect the second half to be harder than the first half. And this can be generalized, we're quite sure, but we didn't try. It should hold for every binary quadratic form, irreducible. You should get a similar result, but the verification is horrible. Slightly later, appearing in 2001, but probably done a year or two earlier, Heath Brown proved the similar asymptotic formula for an even thinner sequence, the ones that are of the form a cubed plus 2b cubed. I leave it to you as an exercise why the 2's there, why it's not a cubed plus b cubed. And this was generalized very recently by Heath Brown and Moraz to general binary cubic forms. Okay, so how am I doing? Oops. So as a result, I make the claim that analytic methods accelerate the sieve. In recent advances, we've used analytic methods to improve the sieve results. We can do things using both methods that we couldn't do with either. And a rough reason, which you can say, is the following. This is the sum we're interested in, sum p less than or equal xap. We can't get it by analytic methods because the generating Dirichlet series is too ugly. It doesn't have nice analytic properties that we can use. But sieve methods allow us to reduce sums over primes to sums over multiples of a given D. maybe with Mobius functions in there. And analytic methods find these sums much easier. So the sieve method sort of gets you part way, and then the analytic method helps you show the error terms are not too bad. Now let me give you an example. Actually, this is a rather old example. Here's the sequence that we'd like to study for the twin prime problem. That's the sequence we start with. And the sieve method tells us, reduces that to the number of multiples of D in this set. We want to study the primes in this set, and the sieve method reduces it to studying the multiples of D. But the number of P minus 2 up to X, which are multiples of D, is just the primes up to X plus 2, which are in the residue class 2 mod D. So that transforms the twin prime problem, in a sense, into studying the primes in an arithmetic progression. And as I pointed out earlier, that's one of the things the analytic method has had some very striking successes, albeit not all the way that it would like to, but there have been very striking successes studying primes in arithmetic progressions using analytic methods. Another way that analysis creeps up in is for more reasonable sequences even, where we're counting the number of integers up to X. Actually, this example is a bad one, but it illustrates a point. It illustrates the point well. You need to complicate it a little to make it accurate. The remainder term was a fractional part. The fractional part of something it's a function with a very simple Fourier series. So if you expand the fractional part function into a Fourier series, you can study sums of these guys using Fourier techniques. Third example I want to use is, let me talk a little bit about the new error term. Recall we pointed out that the study of the sum of the Mobius function up to X is equivalent to the study of the number of primes up to X. The prime number theorem was there was an equivalent form of the prime number theorem. There was an equivalent form of the Riemann hypothesis. And so it's reasonable to believe that, although it doesn't make life easier, that if you want to study this sum, you could equivalently study this sum. This really isn't going to help you, because you would expect, if this analogy holds any water, that this one's going to be just as difficult as this one. But the new error term, if you look at it, it's sort of looks like that one, but in an average sense. And you can all believe that if you have to show something is usually good, that's a lot easier than showing something is always good. So that's another way that... Okay, now, I don't know what to do now. My time is up, and I had these two transparencies, which I added on because I was afraid I didn't have enough. So I think I'm just going to leave them out and say that I think that it's really very interesting that we are starting to make some progress with these things. As you can see, all these famous conjectures on transparency one will outlive all of us, probably, but we're chipping away, and it's fun. Thank you very much.